The clerk will call the next case.
Sheehy versus Williams and Sheehy versus Williams. Brandon Ziegler, Kellum Parks, Aaron McDaniel, appellant's counsel, Kevin Martingale, appellee's counsel. Mr. Garber, please bring over Mr. Ziegler and Mr. Martingale. Everyone, this will take approximately 30 seconds.
It appears that both counsel are there. Mr. Ziegler, are you going to argue the appellant's cause?
I am, Your Honor. I am, Justice.
All right, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning. I am Brandon Ziegler, arguing on behalf of Ms. Sheehy. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
I'd like to start our position with subsection B of our brief, specifically the statute at issue. The statute at issue is 18.2, 386.2, and it says in relevant sections, any person who, with the intent to coerce, harass, or intimidate, maliciously disseminates or sells any videographic or still image of the person who is nude is liable under class one misdemeanor. There is under here it's a civil issue, and therefore the statute says that to find a civil penalty, we have to find a violation of this statute. This has two particular aspects to it that has to be addressed. For Ms. Williams to prevail, she had to have proved that Ms. Sheehy did two things, that with the intent to coerce, harass, and intimidate, Ms. Sheehy did maliciously disseminate images of Ms. Williams in the nude. So when we start at that point, because if we cannot prove that aspect, we will not need to reach the damages argument. In this particular case, the issues of dissemination come first. The dissemination occurred or could have only occurred in two distinct areas. The first is when Ms. Sheehy gave the images that was in her possession to Mr. Garriott, her third counsel. If the court finds that is a dissemination, this court has put an amazing chilling effect on attorney-client communication in that the testimony through Mr. Garriott at the trial that was unrebutted was that the images, and also through the testimony of her prior to counsel, was the images were only in Mr. Garriott's possession. My client, Ms. Sheehy, had these images for in excess of 18 months, did not give them to her first counsel, did not give them to her second counsel, who was co-counsel with Mr. Garriott, and only handed them to Mr. Garriott in preparation for the divorce case in which adultery was alleged in an amended complaint once the evidence was sufficient to allow such amendment. So if we say that that was dissemination, we call into question what communication is protected through the attorney-client communication. We have a long line of rules that put forth that the attorney and client should have free and open communicate to allow the attorney to give free and frank advice. If we say that level of communication violated this statute, then it calls into question what communication between attorney and client does not violate the statute. The next aspect would be the dissemination at the deposition. At the deposition, Mr. Garriott disseminated the images to the people there. Ms. Sheehy saw them, Ms. Williams saw them, Ms. Williams' counsel saw them, court reporter, and the guardian ad litem. All officers of the court, except the court reporter, and all had a role in the deposition. It was not disseminated outside of that room, nor, as the testimony is clear, did anyone keep a copy thereafter. Mr. Garriott accumulated all the copies and kept them. So was that malicious dissemination? The only cases that I could find reported on this statute dealt with criminal aspects of it, where someone posted the images on Facebook or sent links to individuals who were not the subject of the images. That's
counsel. This is Justice McCall. How could it not be under the plain language meaning of dissemination? It's just spreading around. I mean, it may be limited in scope. It's not on the internet. It's not to flyers that you're handing out in the public square. But you're spreading it around, and so maybe that affects the scope of your damages if it has a limited sweep of dissemination. But typically we go to plain language, understand the malice argument, but as to the dissemination piece, how can it not be dissemination to spread it around to a group of people?
Sure. The standard here is not whether it was disseminated. The standard here as the plain meaning, again, Justice, you indicated we deal with the plain meaning in the words before us, and I don't disagree.
Right.
Plain meaning, the legislature, where we have to assume that they chose the words carefully and they meant the words they chose. They modified the word dissemination with the word maliciously. It does not say dissemination, period.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understand then. So you're not saying it wasn't disseminated. You're saying it was disseminated, but not maliciously.
I am correct, Your Honor. Correct.
Okay. All right. I'm with you. Go on.
On the statute, specifically say maliciously disseminated. And in this case, the dissemination was done, I would argue, both in a reserved manner, a confined manner, in a manner respectful both of the process and in necessity in furtherance of the goals at issue. And the goals at issue at that particular time was a custody ruling that would keep Miss Williams away from the minor children of Mr. and Mrs. then Randolph, now Miss Sheehy.
Well, counsel, what about some of the actions and statements of your client beyond just the four walls of this law office? So she had some conduct and statements outside of that. Couldn't the trial court consider those things and decide that was done with malice? And also, this information could have gotten out without the photos being published. So she could have pointed out, I'm aware of this, this has happened, as opposed to this sort of ambush with these embarrassing photos. So could all of that together mean the trial or the fact finder, the jury, could reach a finding of malice as opposed to sort of the isolated, more clinical, just within the four walls of the law firm deposition?
Respectfully, no. And they could not. One, because in this case, the fact finder was the bench trial, was the judge. And here the statute, again, the plain meaning of the statute says any person who, with the intent, coerce or harass or intimidate, maliciously disseminates the images. It has nothing to do here with what she says. The statute does not criminalize or allow a civil cause of action for what she says. She could have spoken to anybody and described in detail what she observed, and it would not be violative of this statute. This statute is specifically isolated to images. It is colloquially referred to as the revenge porn statute, and that is probably the best definition of it. And we all know the famous definition of porn. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. So here, what she said outside of this, as you say, this clinical aspect, this deposition, has no bearing whatsoever on whether Miss Williams is entitled to damages based on the dissemination. If she had said something false, then she may be liable for defamation. But that's not what we're here on today. We're only here on the specific statute, and this specific statute deals with images and images alone. So I respectfully disagree with that position.
But malice is a state of mind, and it's notoriously hard to pin down. And so typically, it's most often parsed out in criminal cases, but, where the court says, well, your acts and statements and so on can help the fact finder reach the conclusion that someone did or didn't act with malice. So maybe that's somehow distinct from this particular context. But traditionally, when we look at malice, we look at the bigger picture and what someone has said and done. And it might have been before or after, but it illumines what the state of mind of malice was at a particular time.
I do not disagree with your statement in general. I disagree of its applicability to these facts here. And the reason I do so is the record is devoid of any statements that my client made outside of the proceeding to anyone that has any level of malice involved in them. The word malice has to deal here with the conduct. What was done with the images and by whom? And the by whom is as important as what was done. What was done is my client gave them to her counsel to seek advice, clearly a protected aspect. Then her counsel, who has the right under Professional Rules 1.6 to conduct the trial and conduct the pretrial depositions and discovery as he sees fit in this case, used the images in a deposition to gain leverage against Mr. Randolph, not to gain leverage against Ms. Williams, against Mr. Randolph to help sway the guardian to recommend that Mr. Williams should not have, Mr. Randolph should not have children, the children around someone with he had a romantic relationship. And that ultimate language was included in the party separation agreement, which was signed immediately before trial. It's further interesting to note in the depositions, Waits had counsel did not object to the images coming in, did not seek to halt the deposition, did not seek a protective order through the court. The court was available by phone. None of that occurred. So while we, again, traditionally will look to all aspects of malice, both what was said and what was done here, the record is devoid of anything maliciously that was said. And we look to the conduct, and the conduct in all candor, Your Justice, incredibly reserved based upon this lady having an adulterous affair with my client's husband. She withheld the images. It was not posted anywhere. It was given to one of her three counsel and used one time in a deposition, and then the divorce case settled. In fact, I would argue that it was used most appropriately and in the most limited possible way to gain the desired outcome of keeping the children away from a person that my client did not feel was appropriate for her children to be around. And the defense of her children was sacrosanct her position. I see my time that I have reserved is running down. I'd like to reserve those last 3 minutes.
All right. Mr. Martingale.
Thank you. My name is Kevin Martingale. I represent Ms. Williams in this appeal. And I'd like to start with a procedural issue because we were asked to be prepared to discuss this. And this is the motion to dismiss the appeal as moot that I filed on behalf of my client. I've seen the response that was filed on behalf of Ms. Sheehy. She does not allege that she was forced to sell her home. She does not allege that we did anything that forced her to pay the judgment. There is nothing indicating that the judgment was paid under protest. And in fact, the document that's in the record that arrived with the check has initials right in the middle of the page that are Ms. Sheehy's initials, which I would interpret to mean she agreed that that money would be distributed from the purchaser's funds. There is literally nothing that we can see that indicates that there was any resistance to paying this voluntarily because she voluntarily decided to sell her home. And so as I interpret the cases from this court previously, that makes this appeal moot. Moving on to the arguments that have already been presented by opposing counsel. The first thing I'd like to do is to focus on what motivated both Ms. Sheehy and her attorney. And it's very simple. One word describes both. Ms. Sheehy was angry, and we have pointed out the pages at page 10 of our brief. And Mr. Garriott was motivated by a desire to exert leverage on behalf of his client. Leverage with these photos would not be a legitimate use of evidence. There was no intent to use this evidence during the trial. How do we know that? Because my client was not listed as a witness. This evidence was not listed on a pretrial order. And the discovery didn't even mention Renee Williams as a factor in any of the custody or visitation issues. This was a total ambush. There was no legitimate use. And we know that the other side is not relying upon the potential defenses, if they apply, of judicial privilege or advice of counsel, because they conceded at page 7 of the rebuttal brief that they are not relying on those defenses. So there was plenty of evidence, and it's been conceded, that there was dissemination, even if it was limited dissemination. And there is evidence in the record that the trial judge was entitled to rely upon of malice. improper purposes, something other than a legitimate use of evidence for purposes of litigation and legitimate claims. Not only that, but there was testimony from the guardian ad litem that she was actually misled by Ms. Sheehy into believing that these activities had occurred in a location where they did not occur. She thought they had occurred in the former marital property that was being occupied by Mr. Randolph before he was deployed overseas as part of his military duties, when in fact, all of these images occurred in Ms. Williams' own home. It wasn't until we were in this case, the case that brings us into court today, that she found out for the very first time that actually none of this could conceivably have involved or affected the Randolph children. So Ms. Sheehy never contended anything in the discovery that would have made it relevant. None of this was going to be presented during a trial. The guardian ad litem was misled about the nature of the images and how they were captured and where they were captured. None of this was proper. And the trial judge was entitled to review that evidence and arrive at the conclusion that this was done for the kinds of reasons that the General Assembly saw fit to stop. This is a statute that has nothing to do with the common law tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress, what the other side has tried to bring into this. This is a statute with clear elements. All of the elements were proved, and Ms. Williams got the type of relief that is contemplated under the statute. And in fact, I would submit to you that the trial judge showed great restraint. It was a modest award of compensatory damages. It was a modest award of punitive damages. And it was a carefully calibrated award of attorney's fees and costs after a hard-fought, long-litigated matter that went all the way through trial into a final decision. So for those reasons, we feel that this was handled very well and capably by the trial judge, and he showed great restraint in terms of coming out with the final outcome. In terms of handing off this information to her attorney, it's a long recognized principle in the law that you cannot do indirectly what you may not do directly. And it's already been conceded that the information was first disseminated to her lawyer and then by her lawyer, who is her agent, to a bunch of people in a room who had absolutely no need to see any of this. And it obviously was a horrifying experience to a non-party to that case who was compelled to come in pursuant to a subpoena and sit for a deposition that she could be a part of. She was forced into this. And once again, there was no legitimate purpose for this whatsoever.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may briefly interrupt, I just want to make sure, based upon your first point, that my facts are right. The defendant in this case has paid 100% of the judgment voluntarily. Is that right? There was no stay or supersedis bond, and there was no reservation of rights, and there was no agreement that the voluntary payment would not affect the appeal. Are all these facts right?
That is absolutely correct.
That means the case is over.
That would be our interpretation. There was one additional form of relief that was awarded in the final judgment, and that was injunctive relief, but that was not objected to, and it is not a part of this appeal because it's not a part of any of the assignments of error.
So the entire appeal is challenging the monetary relief, and the monetary relief was 100%, if I'm reading your affidavit correctly, 100% paid.
Yes, sir. And an update to that is that we, in accordance with 8.01-454, notified the clerk 2 days ago that the judgment has been satisfied because we're compelled to do that. We have
to
do that.
So you've actually signed you've already filed a satisfaction of judgment in the lower court.
We did, Your Honor, because we have to, in accordance with that code section, or we would run into problems.
There's really nothing for us to reverse.
That is our position.
So she sold her home. There was a lien. In the process of selling the home, lien was satisfied. I mean, that's basically where we are, right?
So what? That is correct. And there was nothing.
Suppose she wanted to keep the ball in play. I guess one answer would be, well, wait to sell your home till the case is over. Or what else could she have done to avoid the argument that, well, now the case is over?
Well, first she could have sought to post a bond that would have satisfied that. And there are a number of ways to do that. You can do that at the beginning or you can do it midstream. She could have at least paid it under protest, indicated something in writing somewhere by somebody that this was being paid under protest, which would at least give you the opportunity to evaluate whether that is sufficient. There was nothing communicated verbally, in writing, or otherwise indicating that this check was showing up as a payment under protest or anything of that nature. It was simply paid.
But I mean, it is a little different than the situation where someone says, you know what, I'm tired of fighting. Here's a check. Make it go away. I'm done with this case. Here she's selling her home. Now, I understand your point. I'm not asking you to concede anything. It's just a little bit different than some of the cases I was looking at where it just looks like someone just paid it and, having satisfied it, then wanted to keep fighting.
I would agree with that, certainly. But here's the other thing. I've been trying to think what happens if you don't dismiss it as moot, and for whatever reason, you reject all of my arguments and you decide to reverse this. It has been paid. We have indicated in writing back to the clerk that it has been satisfied. Then what? I was taken by the sentence in a dissent, a different case entirely, but Justice Kelsey wrote it and was joined by Justice Goodwin, pointing out that once a judgment is voluntarily paid, there is literally no order from the Supreme Court that can reverse that. And I really don't know procedurally how this would go. In researching cases from other jurisdictions, there's a little bit more discussion about that, how they talk about there's really no way to undo it. But I think mechanically and procedurally, we would be getting into a quagmire here if we don't recognize that this has mooted the financial aspect of this case, and the injunctive aspect is simply not on appeal.
Yeah, this is Justice Goodwin. In order for the motion to dismiss to be granted, it has to be shown that the payment was voluntary. How does this appellate court make that factual determination on this record?
First, I would tell you to look at the payment itself, and secondly, to look at what was filed in response to our motion, which does not explain any fact that could lead to the conclusion that this is really an issue in controversy. It has all been,
let me stop you just for a second. What about my recollection of their affidavit is they say, we didn't pay it. The people who were buying the house paid it. So it was paid by a volunteer, not by her.
So it was paid by the purchaser's attorney from the funds that otherwise would have gone to Ms. Sheehy. I think the court can take judicial notice of that, that there would be the funds would be distributed in the manner that is dictated by the contract and what liens exist and so forth. And you've got a document that's got the initials of Ms. Sheehy right in the middle of it, which signifies any agreement. It does not say under protest or anything of that nature. And so when we look at what the response is, the response doesn't indicate anything about it being compelled, forced, or paid under protest.
So a payment that's not voluntary would be a writ of fife, a garnishment, a debtor's interrogatory order, something like that, where the court coerces the payment.
That would be our position.
It seems like to me there's no Virginia authority which defines what voluntary means. Correct? I couldn't find any cases that define what voluntary means in this instance.
In this instance, I think that both sides have cited all of the authority that exists. So is nothing clearly defining what constitutes voluntary. But what I would do is I would contrast it with what we know to be involuntary. Involuntary collection proceedings, and I think Justice Kelsey named what those are. When the check shows up, and we didn't do something to make that happen, that's voluntary. Whether it's made by Sheehy herself or her lawyer or a different lawyer, it really doesn't matter. And we've received nothing indicated under protest.
Doesn't it have to be voluntary on the part of Ms. Sheehy? If I go down and pay Ms. Sheehy's judgment, that's not voluntary on her part.
You know, that's candidly, that's a wrinkle I hadn't thought of. But once again, if the judgment is satisfied, even if satisfied by a third party, wouldn't that moot the appeal for purposes of the Supreme Court? It would seem to me that it would, because you're not going to decide something where there's no longer a monetary problem. I mean, that's why we have appeals, because the person who's been told you have to pay doesn't want to pay. Well, what if it's paid by some third party? Does the Supreme Court go ahead and issue an advisory opinion to indicate whether it was right or wrong in the first instance? I would argue that would not be a sound use of judicial resources, and it would turn it into an advisory opinion. Whether it's been paid by somebody else or paid by Ms. Sheehy, I think it's been paid.
But whether that moots her appeal seems to turn, at least historically, on whether it was voluntary. So the key seems to be evidence of the voluntary nature of the payment.
And so I would submit that it doesn't turn as much on exactly who makes it. It turns on the question of whether it was compelled. And we didn't take action to compel it. The judgment was in the record simply because that's how it works. If you get a final judgment order, it is recorded in records, and then it has to be dealt with one way or the other. There were alternatives. There are clear alternatives for a judge that are including posting a suspending bond or doing something else, or at least somehow that it is being made under protest. And that didn't occur. And furthermore, I think that those initials in the middle of that page are fairly interpreted as agreement or consent to this.
Well, it's hard to imagine that the buyers of the home would have volunteered to pay off the HUD statement if the seller wasn't directing them to do it. I mean, so there's an agency relationship right there. Obviously, the seller instructed the buyer to do it. It's not legally possible to violate the HUD otherwise.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I think that if the court feels that it's not clear enough based on what has been filed with the court and based upon what the attorneys argue here today, that one possibility would be to remand it back to the trial court to conduct a proceeding to determine how and why it was paid. I would hope that's not what occurs, because I think that's an expensive thing for both sides. But I do believe that at this point, what we're talking about is an appeal that has become moot. I would rely upon the rest of the materials that I filed as for the rest of our arguments, including the other motion to dismiss that we filed before the brief that pointed out the unusual way that this matter arrived in the court, two consolidated appeals. We believe that's improper for the reasons that we outlined in writing.
And Mr. Martin-Yong, I've got one other question for you about the merits of the case. Under what theory would you ascribe the dissemination of the photos at the deposition by the attorney to Mrs. Sheehy?
The fact that, first of all, he was her agent and attorney. Secondly, at no time during this litigation has she ever tried to disclaim or distance herself from the actions of her lawyer. Third, we know that she was angry, and we know that the attorney was seeking leverage, and so therefore she, in concert with her attorney, acted inappropriately, and I see that I'm now in the red and running out. I'm out of time.
Right, because an interesting thing, the prerequisite for the civil action is a criminal act. Now, if her attorney disseminating this was a criminal act, how can she be found liable for that, the criminal act of her attorney?
May I have leave to answer?
Absolutely.
Because he was acting with her full authority. She's had every opportunity during this litigation to deny or distance herself from what her lawyer did. She never did. She testified at trial, and she made
does she
no...
Have, does she have to deny that? I mean, it seems like to me you'd have to prove that, and you'd have to put something on it. You told him to do that, right? You wanted him to embarrass this woman. I haven't seen anything like that in the record.
We know she was mad, and we know that he used it for improper purposes, and there was no legitimate use. Our theory is this was a joint venture between attorney and client. Both of them had reasons to use this evidence that were not legitimate, that this court should not allow, and that the trial judge did not allow. Thank you.
Thanks, counsel. Thank you.
All right. Rebuttal.
I'd like to address two points, the first being the voluntary nature of payment. If you look at Exhibit A on Mr. Martingale's submission, it is a debt collection letter. It's not a thank you for the payment, it's a debt collection letter. In fact, at the bottom it has what we call in the industry a mini Miranda warning. It says, this is an attempt to collect the debt, and for any information obtained will be for that purpose. And it goes on to say, this is a communication from a debt collector. What's most interesting in this letter is I'm not copying. It's not.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. The check from Trapani's trust account says judgment payoff, It's in the exact amount of the monetary judgment that you're appealing. Did your client authorize that payment to be made? That check, check 20100.
As I sit here today, I do not know that. I was not involved in the real estate transaction in any regard, nor made aware of it, and I wasn't copied.
Okay, you don't know, but let's face it. Is there any way in the world that someone off of a HUD issues a check in that amount without the authority of the person who owns the money?
I do not. I know Mr. Trapani. I know him to be a counsel of merit and honor, and I do not believe he would do so without some ability either in the law or by expression.
Well, you represent your client, and if your client saw this check and it wasn't something she authorized, I imagine you would be here telling us, I don't know how that check got issued. My client did not authorize it. I haven't paid anything. I still want to contest this.
I still argue that I have not paid anything voluntarily. You have the case of Carlucci versus Duck Real Estate. It says a payment made after the judgment creditor has issued an execution on its judgment and filed a suggestion and garnishment was not a voluntary payment. You also have
right, because those judgment collection devices are not the function of the party. It's the function of a court. The court issues the 5A. The court issues the garnishment. The court strings someone up on debtor's interrogatories. But just writing a letter saying, one, I got a judgment against you. Two, you haven't paid it. Three, you have not asked for a superseded stay. Please pay the judgment. How is that involuntary when you stroke a check that pays the judgment?
Sure. I'm going to rely on the case of Wells versus Wells, 1997, Virginia App, Lexus 703. The court found that a payment after, and this is domestic case, that the party registered his objections, properly noted an appeal, and only satisfied the judgment afterwards to avoid imminent judicial sale of the property, payment was not voluntary. We also have Moore versus Moore, again, a court of appeals matter, 211, Virginia App, Lexus 75. Payments made after an appeal was noted, objections noted, was not a voluntary payment. There's nothing voluntary. This money did not come from my client's checking account. This money did not come from anyone on her behalf. This was obligated to transfer property, so she was not in default on a real estate contract. I see I've run out of my 3 minutes. I'm happy to answer your question.
Justice Kelsey, has he answered your question?
He has, thank you.
Anyone else on the panel today have a question to ask? All right, sir, your time has expired.
Thank you.